Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Bioavailability of Contaminants in Soil, Considerations for Human Health Risk Assessment. Today's training is based on our online technical and regulatory guidance document. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training class. I'm Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to quickly cover some introductory material and then turn it over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are scheduled for 2.25 hours. We're recording today's session, and we do offer archives of past ITRC classes. The trainers are going to control the slides today. If you would like to have your own version available where you could stay on a slide longer or look forward through the presentation, it is available to download, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training, you're welcome to use the Q&A box in the lower right to send in questions or comments. During the question and answer break, if you're on the phone line, you can unmute and ask a question out loud, but for the questions you ask out loud, we do ask that you hold them until the question and answer breaks. At the end of the class, we are looking for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the feedback that you provide. The feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So at the end of the class, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the feedback form is going to create that certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that certificate is through the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, and submit again. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by our state regulators. Our federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. We also include members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of documents. We have our online and classroom training schedule for 2018 available now. There's also a wide variety of past classes available in the archives. I'll introduce our trainers. On the bottom of the slide is a link where you can read more about the trainers' bios. Our first trainer today will be Bryn Toms with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Next, we'll hear from Rivette Loney, who's with CERTIP. We also have Kevin Long from RAMBA, Valerie Haney at the California DTSC, and Anita Meyer with the U.S. Army Corps. I'll now turn it over to our first trainer, Bryn Toms with the Oregon DEQ.
Thanks, Juliana. So today we're going to talk about a few things. This is a roadmap of what we're going to talk about. We'll first start off with an intro section talking about the importance of evaluating bioavailability. It'll be fairly brief. And then we'll move into bioavailability basics that'll talk about some definitions, a little bit of history about bioavailability, how we got to be where we're at. Basically stuff that'll help you guys understand the rest of the presentation today. Then we'll move into the first case study, which will be on arsenic. And then we'll have a Q&A session in between that, and then we'll have a case study very similar to the first one, but it'll be on lead. And then we'll have a discussion on the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and then we'll all wrap it up in the end in a summary, taking action. So let's just jump right in. So what is bioavailability? It can be kind of a mouthful. But basically, the concept of bioavailability is essentially getting at essentially how much of a contaminant that might be ingested would actually get into the bloodstream. And that's an important aspect here. You'll hear different terms like relative bioavailability and some other things like that. And there's definitely some specific definitions to consider as we go through the presentation. But the idea here simply is if a contaminant doesn't enter the bloodstream and move into the body and doesn't cause an effect, then it's not bioavailable. And oftentimes we assess the total concentrations and use those to compare to generic screening values, when really, in fact, a lot of times the bioavailability of that contaminant actually isn't as high as we might think. So here's a quick poll question. And the question here is, if a contaminant, and let me back up a little bit. This is just to kind of get you thinking about sort of risk assessment, exposure pathways, and complete exposure pathways. But the poll question is, if a contaminant is ingested and passes through, is not absorbed from the human gastrointestinal tract, does it contribute to systemic risk? And the question, obviously, or the answer would be yes, no, or I don't know. And I'll give you guys a few seconds here to see what kind of questions or kind of answers we get. Looks like this looks kind of similar to what we were getting on the first webinar, where about 70% of the folks are saying no. And I think, you know, this could be sort of an esoteric question if you wanted to get into the details of where the end of the exposure pathway is and where the receptor begins. But in this particular case, we're talking about bioavailability. We would say that no, if it doesn't move into the bloodstream, passes right through the body, then essentially it's not bioavailable and doesn't contribute to systemic risk. So let's see, moving on. Today we hope that you'll be learning a few concepts. We hope that you'll be learning to value the ITRC document as a go-to resource for soil bioavailability. This is much like a few of the ITRC documents that folks have kind of come to use as a guide for a lot of things. We hope that you'll be able to apply the decision process to determine when a site-specific bioavailability assessment may be appropriate, and we'll talk further about that decision process as we go through some of the case studies. We hope that you'll be able to use the ITRC review checklist to develop or review a risk assessment that has soil bioavailability in it, and that kind of walks through some of the elements of what a soil bioavailability assessment includes. And then you should be able to learn the factors that affect arsenic, lead, and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon bioavailability, pH bioavailability. That's a little easier. And then also we hope you'll be able to select the appropriate methods to evaluate bioavailability and be able to incorporate all of that into a risk assessment. So those are sort of our goals today. So you might ask yourself, why should I evaluate bioavailability? And there's a few reasons why. One is it reduces uncertainty, and we know that in risk assessment, that's one of the objectives in risk assessment is to reduce the uncertainty. You want to have representative risk. It also leads to a more effective use of resources, and it doesn't compromise the health protection because we're still going after the same target risk level. And it might reduce remedial action costs and increase the flexibility of remedial options. So instead of digging up a large area that maybe doesn't need to be removed, you could maybe focus in some of the funding on certain areas that do need to be excavated. And another important part is that in risk assessment, there is the allowance of modifying exposure factors to better represent site conditions. So this would be nothing different than modifying a daily ingestion rate or maybe an exposure duration. This is a very similar aspect in risk assessment. This is a quick screenshot of our ITRC guidance document on the webpage, and we'll talk about this a little further in the summary section, but the team worked on this for about 2.5 years, and we feel pretty good about the product. I encourage everybody to go to the URL there after this presentation and just kind of pick through here and kind of get a sense of what this is all about. I hope it'll help galvanize some of the concepts today. So today, the focus of the training and also the guidance is on a few things. Specifically, it's on the bioavailability of contaminants in soil to humans. So this doesn't include ecological receptors, doesn't include sediment. However, that was covered in a 2011 ITRC document, and it is specific to arsenic, lead, and PAHs. But I think an important item that our team has kind of emphasized is that this can be used for other contaminants. And I think a lot of the folks would like to encourage people to look outside of just those three contaminants and actually see if we can continue developing methods for other contaminants. It focuses on the soil ingestion pathway only. So it doesn't include like plant uptake or something along those lines. And it has some limited dermal bioavailability information as it relates to the PAHs. And I mentioned a couple of these. So the bioavailability tools that you have available to you, one is the web-based guidance document that I showed the picture of the web page on. We're hoping this will be the go-to guide for bioavailability assessments. And then we have some handout items that you might have picked up at the beginning when you entered the webinar. One is the decision process flowchart, and that's section 4.1 of our guidance document. We'll talk about those. We'll kind of pick through some of those pieces of the flowchart in each of the case studies. And then there's a definition of terms, which is very important because it gets into the nitty-gritty of what like relative bioavailability means or some of those other terms that you'll hear today. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there's the review checklist. And that just helps you understand what kind of elements you need to check off as you either review an assessment or if you actually prepare a bioavailability assessment. You want to make sure you've got certain elements in there. And again, all of these will be discussed further as we move through this presentation today. So I'll wrap this up real quick. We had a poll question earlier. Juliana, can you bring up that one question? And we'll look at the results. And if you haven't answered it, maybe you could answer it right now. But the question is about what your experience level is with soil contaminant bioavailability. And I'll talk a little bit about sort of my background and how I kind of got involved with it. And what I think we're seeing here is 50% are saying about little or no experience. 50% are saying some knowledge and experience. And then a few folks are saying they have some expert knowledge in this arena. And I think that's again, similar to what we saw in the previous webinar. When I first started working on bioavailability and sort of understanding it, I was certainly in the little or no experience area. I've come from sort of a hydrogeologist background and relied on the risk assessors to look at the details of a risk assessment. A couple years back, or a few years back, we were working on a project in Oregon where we had a large 17-mile-long abandoned railroad that was chock full of arsenic from abandoned mine tailings. And the whole road basically needed to be removed if we use the default values, screening values. And so the responsible party hired an expert in this arena, and we walked through this with a really detailed work plan and a few meetings. And in the end, our toxicologist, the regulatory agency, and myself were in agreement with going down that road. And it turned out that the risk was a lot lower than we anticipated. So what was great about that is it significantly reduced the remedial action cost. And that was good because we actually did have some sites that did need excavation. And so we focused the time and energy and money on those. And it also increased the accuracy of the risk estimate. It was a really good project for me. I learned a lot, and that's kind of how I got involved with this this team. So now I'm going to turn this over to Yvette Lowney, who's the technical advisor to CERDIP, and she's going to start talking about some of the bioavailability basics that we need to understand as we walk through this today.
Thanks, Bryn. Thanks for the introduction. I'm going to be providing a little bit of information on the history and background of bioavailability, how we came to know that bioavailability adjustments are appropriate for incorporation into human health risk assessments. And before I launch into that, I just want to say for me, it's particularly, I've been doing this kind of work in doing research and incorporating bioavailability adjustments into risk assessment for a few decades, more than I probably want to admit. But it's really fun to be on this team and to be on this training because I was the toxicologist that came in to work with Oregon DEQ and talk to them about implementing bioavailability adjustments in that site that Bryn just mentioned. And so we kind of started with some basics and worked our way up, and then it was so exciting when I got to the ITRC meetings and found Bryn there where he thought it was such a great tool that he wanted to make sure other regulators were aware of it and how to use it. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about history, relevance to human health risk assessment, some of the concepts and how that applies to incorporating bioavailability adjustments, key definitions, including explaining what an in vivo to in vitro correlation is, so that if, as our subsequent sections talk about that, you're familiar with the concept, and also touch on some of the soil properties that influence bioavailability. So this slide presents some data that were published by Martha Steele in 1990. And what she did was that she looked at lead data from different types of lead contaminated sites. So she had, looking for my pointer, she included mining sites with lead contamination, urban areas that had lead contamination, and also smelter studies. Studies from smelter sites. And what she was looking at was the blood lead of children who lived in these communities and the soil lead concentrations and how those two correlated. So what's on the y-axis in these graphs is the relationship between blood lead and soil lead. So it is the change in blood lead for every 1,000 part per million of soil lead. And the point of this slide is to depict that if you have a smelter site, the relationship between blood lead and soil lead is much higher than, say, if you live at a mining site. So, and if you are at this kind of mining site where there appears to be no relationship between your children's blood lead and the soil lead in the community that you live in, you are pretty dubious when somebody comes in and says, I want to scrape up all of your gardening and landscaping that you've put in. We're here to help you, and we're going to do it by taking this lovely community. This happens to be very close to where I am. This was a site in the Rocky Mountains. We're going to take this lovely community where you came to be able to engage in the outdoors, and we are going to sanitize it for you. So, incorporating bioavailability adjustments isn't always about only reducing remediation costs. It also can have significant impacts on the people who live in the areas of remediation. So those were data, that last slide was data from epidemiology studies, so human data. The next few slides present data from animal studies. So these are studies of blood lead concentrations over time. So along the x-axis is the study day, where swine, immature swine, were exposed to lead. And the key here explains what they were exposed to. So there were some that were exposed to no lead. Those are our controls. And then they were exposed to either low dose or high dose of soluble lead, or those same doses administered in the soil. And so not unexpectedly, you can see that if you dose an animal with lead after you dose them, their blood lead levels go up. And you keep dosing them after a few days and it hits a plateau. And this is the blood lead level that arises from a high level of soluble lead exposure. If you give them a lower dose of lead, not surprisingly, their blood lead level is lower. But what was interesting to see is even if you take this high dose, but you are administering it in a form of soil from one of these mining sites, the blood lead levels are much lower. And similarly, the same was true if you take a low dose, the blood lead levels are much lower if the dose is administered in a soil. So those are the technical underpinnings that establish, wow, the bioavailability, something's going on. Lead is not being absorbed the same from some of these soils as it is if it's dosed in a soluble form. So risk assessment guidance, those of you who've been doing risk assessment know that the risk assessment guidance for Superfund that came out in 1989 is kind of the Bible. But even back in 1989, there was an acknowledgement that there may be some site-specific factors that need to be incorporated. And so that guidance said, if the medium of exposure at the site, such as soil, differs from the medium of exposure assumed by the toxicity value, so the RFD, the cancer slope factor, then an absorption adjustment might be appropriate. And this is done to adjust a food or soil ingestion exposure estimate to match based on the matrix that was administered in the toxicity study. So said another way, the risk assessment process has two major components. There's a toxicity assessment, and this is usually done in animals or from epidemiology studies, where the study is usually conducted on soluble forms of the chemical of interest. And then there's the exposure assessment, where we're looking at how people in the community or under the situation we're assessing are exposed. And so what the bioavailability adjustment does is it makes sure that we have an apples-to-apples comparison between these two, right? So we have bioavailability in the toxicity assessment, and those are the assessments that form the RFD or the cancer slope factor. And then we might have some site-specific bioavailability considerations that are associated with the exposure medium at the site. And incorporating a bioavailability adjustment into the risk assessment process makes sure that these are on an apples-to-apples basis. So this is just a definition of what a relative oral bioavailability is. And generally, it is the RBA that we are incorporating into a risk assessment. So it is the comparison of the bioavailability of a chemical in different dosing media. For our purposes, we're talking about soils in the ITRC guidance document. We're looking at the absolute bioavailability from soil compared to the absolute bioavailability of the chemical form dosed in the critical toxicity study. And that's our RBA. So this slide will show up later when we're going through some case studies, but this shows you where bioavailability is incorporated into the risk assessment. So you can see there are many considerations that go into the exposure calculation, the concentrations of chemical in soil, the ingestion rate of soil, how often people are exposed, how long they're exposed, and then factors of averaging time and body weight to get the dose correct. But also the bioavailability can be considered in that exposure estimate. So one of the points that we make in the guidance document and that we want to make sure you understand here is that these considerations may apply to a wide variety of chemicals. Our guidance is focused primarily on lead and arsenic for inorganic chemicals and on PAHs for organic chemicals. So these are all chemicals that are high in the list of priority chemicals specified by the Centers for Disease Control. And so those have been areas where research has focused historically, but conceptually these concepts apply broadly to other chemicals. So again, just some more definitions. One of the ways that people want to estimate bioavailability is by using inexpensive chemical extraction techniques. So bioavailability studies involve animals. They are complicated. They are difficult to interpret. They require a lot of resources. And so unless you have a really big site with lots of resources to command for research, you may not be able to do an actual animal study to assess bioavailability. But therefore, methods have been developed where we can use simple chemical extraction techniques. And so we call that bioaccessible. So that is the mass of a chemical in soil that is soluble divided by the total mass present. And it's referred to in our documents as the IVBA, or in vitro bioaccessibility. It's referred to in the literature under many terms, but all similar in concept. So this is a schematic that illustrates the issues of bioavailability and bioaccessibility. This is a figure from the ITRC guidance document, and basically what it is depicting is our interest is exposure to contaminants in soil. And primarily we talk about the ingestion exposure pathway. So soils get ingested, they go to the gastrointestinal tract, the stomach. Some of the chemicals dissolve off of the soils in the gastrointestinal tract, and some of those chemicals that dissolve from the soil then get absorbed into the bloodstream. These little red worm-like things are not disease organisms. Those are supposed to represent the blood vessels and the chemicals getting into the blood. So bioaccessibility, these chemical extraction methods, take the soil, put them into some sort of test tube. It's conducted in vitro in the laboratory, and this we can then estimate, get measures of the bioaccessible, the soluble fraction. Bioavailability is measured in animals, where you take the soil, you administer it to animals, and you assess an endpoint, frequently how that chemical gets into the blood of those animals. So this is just a schematic in the document to illustrate the different concepts of bioaccessibility and bioavailability. One of the other important things that we address in the document and will be discussed, used later in the in our training, has to do with using bioaccessibility to predict bioavailability. So bioaccessibility is simple and easy to measure in the lab. Bioavailability is usually measured in larger, more complex studies. And we know that bioaccessibility is a predictor of bioavailability if we can establish that there is a correlation. And that is done, for example, by using linear regression analysis. And the relationship between the bioaccessibility and the bioavailability is explained by the regression equation. So in this kind of situation, when you have bioaccessibility data, you take your soils, you get a estimate of bioaccessibility, you then use this regression equation to estimate bioavailability. And again, it's defined by the equation, and this will vary depending on the in vitro method, depending on the chemical of concern. In the past, people have asked, well, gee, who does these IV-IVCs? So IV-IVC is in vivo to in vitro correlation. These usually result from research and large-scale efforts. It would be unusual to do an IV-IVC specific to a small site, but there are IV-IVC methods available for application at sites. So again, the IV-IVC refers to a correlation between in vitro bioaccessibility and in vivo bioavailability results. And you have a good correlation. If you have a good correlation, that means your in vitro method is going to provide you a reliable estimate of bioavailability. If that correlation is not good, then it means your in vitro method appears to not be adequately related to bioavailability, and therefore it can't be used to predict bioavailability. One of the last things I want to talk about is what we know about the factors in soil that affect bioavailability. This is a schematic, again, from the ITRC document that addresses what we know about how lead and arsenic interact with soil and how those interactions affect the bioavailability. So on the left-hand side, we have low bioavailability. On the right-hand side, we have high bioavailability. And so one of the things we know is that the mineral form of the metal can really affect the bioavailability. So if you have a lead carbonate, for example, it's very highly soluble in gastric fluid, and it is highly bioavailable. Whereas if you have a lead sulfide, it is very low, the solubility is low and the bioavailability is low. Another factor that has been shown to affect bioavailability is the particle size in the soil. Different sites have different particle size distributions. And what we have found is that the particle size where these contaminants are present can affect the bioavailability. And any of us who have tried to dissolve sugar in our iced tea knows that the smaller, finely divided white sugar dissolves much more quickly than the large raw sugar nuggets or or larger sugar crystals. Well, the same is often true for bioavailability and solubility of these chemicals from soils. There are also factors associated with the components of the soil that are affecting bioavailability. One of the main things that can affect it is even if you have a very soluble form of a metal, so this is a lead carbonate factor particle, that particle may be encapsulated, for example, within slag at a smelting site or within quartz at a mining site. And to the extent that this quartz, that it surrounds the soluble form of lead is not soluble, this lead particle becomes insoluble and therefore not bioavailable. So the last thing I want to touch on is regulatory recognition of using bioavailability and risk assessment. So for lead, there is specific guidance on using bioavailability in the risk assessment of lead-contaminated sites. And that includes bioaccessibility methods for estimating bioavailability. For arsenic, there's been a ton of research done, and over the course of while we were writing the ITRC guidance, the EPA approved an in vitro method for estimating bioavailability of arsenic from soils. So both of those types of documents are available from EPA. The EPA has also completed a review of the available information on dioxins. The conclusions of their analysis is there clearly seem to be factors, site-specific factors, that affect the bioavailability of dioxins. But at this point in time, that the information is not clear in terms of what exactly those factors are, nor whether there is a specific in vitro method or even an animal method that EPA endorses for assessing bioavailability. States also have found that they have some state-specific factors that they want to see incorporated into risk assessments. And so, for example, both California and Hawaii have issued guidance. And so if your site is in those states, it's important to make sure you have acknowledged their guidance and suggested approaches. And on top of guidance, there have been several site-specific precedents. So there have been bioavailability adjustments incorporated into risk assessments for lead, arsenic, cadmium, dioxins, and PAHs, and probably other chemicals too. So it is becoming more widespread. And with that, I think we have another poll question. Julianne, can you launch that? So our question now is, does the state you work in use bioavailability when assessing risk? So what has been your experience in that? We'll give you a couple of minutes to answer the question. And it looks like the respondents are that about half of you or a third of you don't know, more than a third are not sure. So that's something you might want to look into if you have a site that you're going to try and incorporate bioavailability adjustments on. And a good number of you also are aware of site-specific or state-specific approaches. So that's interesting. And then it looks like several of you are aware that there are no site-specific or state-specific values. So with that, I am going to hand over the discussion to Valerie Hanley from the California Department of Toxic Substances and Kevin Long from RAMBL, and they're going to talk about a case study that demonstrates application of some of these processes that I've been discussing.
All right, thank you so much, Yvette. As Yvette said, what we're going to do is work our way through a case study. One of the key things we'll be using is this flow chart, which is part of our ITRC guidance. You should have received this in your materials when you registered. Don't worry, I know it's really small here, but we're going to blow it up. But what we're going to do is present a case study that is very simplified. Just for the purposes of this presentation, it's not a real case, and we understand that many sites will be much more complicated and involve more factors than what we're going into. So we just want you to really remember that as we move through. So we're going to go through each step of this decision process flow chart and talk about them and how you would evaluate each step as you move forward, evaluating whether or not you think conducting a bioavailability study at your site is a worthwhile venture. So we have it broken down into two parts here, and so we'll go through each one of these individually. And we're going to have Kevin Long is going to go ahead and present a case study, the background, and then we'll go work through the process.
Thanks, Valerie. So what I want you to do, again, as Valerie's tried to tee up, this is really a hypothetical. And it's intended to be a tool that might help you to start to visualize how we might step through the process of making a decision as to whether we would account for or work towards actually conducting a site-specific bioavailability study. So Valerie is actually going to help me by coaching me through this process using this hypothetical as an example. We're not going to deal with ecological risk and other aspects of this that might be relevant on a particular site. Again, this is just a hypothetical. So for this example, just imagine a former agricultural parcel that's approximately 100 acres in size that we have information to indicate that pesticides have been used that had arsenic as part of its content. And we have some information regarding the material across the site, the soil in particular, and that it's relatively homogeneous. It's essentially a silty sand. We also have some information to give us an idea as to how this agricultural parcel had been used. Really, what we're seeing are eight distinct fields that were used to grow various crops. And then there's a ninth area that would serve not only as a residential portion of the farm, but also it had buildings and structures that were used to help support the actual implementation of farming on this property. So there were big barns. They might have mixed chemicals, the pesticides that they would have used, any of the herbicides they might have used as part of this farming this site. So I guess with that, Valerie, as part of going through this decision tree process, what would be the first thing I might want to think about?
So the first step is, the big question is, does the project focus on human exposure to contaminated soil? And this seems like a pretty simple question, and it is, but it's important because everything that we present in our guidance document, the methods were all developed, and everything was written in this document focusing on human exposure to contaminated soils. So, and this is, it's known that there are obviously considerations for ecological receptors, but this is a focus on human health assessment. So if your site, if ecological concerns were your top priority, then probably a bioavailability investigation isn't going to be something that you're going to want to look at. So that first question is human exposure to contaminated soil that top risk-driving issue on your site?
So with regards to that, for our example here, we actually do have a situation in which the parcel is planned for future use that would be both a mixed bag of residential and recreational. So this parcel will be redeveloped. Right now the plan is for about 30% of that space to be used as green space, playgrounds, maybe trails, where the remainder of it would be used for residential homes. So obviously as a result of that, we are looking at a situation in which we have potential human exposure. And you can imagine, with regards to the residential land use, you could have kids playing in the backyard. You could have some individuals who like to play and get a little dirty. So definitely something that we need to consider. And we also have recreational possibilities. So situations in which individuals could become exposed to the arsenic in soil as a result of those activities. So I guess with that, Val, what might be the next thing I should think about in terms of, whether I might want to consider evaluating and incorporating into my risk assessment for this particular site in order to help me make a decision about whether I need to do anything to protect human health after redevelopment.
So the next big question is, does the project focus on soil ingestion? So again, is that risk-driving portion of your site going to be soil ingestion? Because again, the methods that we present in this document and the discussion of bioavailability is based off of ingestion of soils. We do touch on pHs and some dermal absorption, but for the most part, particularly for arsenic, we're looking at soil ingestion. And it's only the soil ingestion portions of the risk assessment you would actually modify with that RBA value. This is a figure you've seen before. Yvette presented this. And this is just showing you where that RBA value, the relative bioavailability, which is the number you're going to generate through these studies, where that is incorporated into the risk assessment equation. This is the example for ingestion. And so it's important to know you're only only modifying that ingestion pathway. So you wouldn't use this RBA in your inhalation or your dermal. So if inhalation risk is driving your site, then perhaps bioavailability isn't your best case or your best evaluation source. Finally, it's really important when we talk about arsenic in soils to know what the background concentration of arsenic is in your soils. And the reason for this is that the background arsenic levels in soil across the world really are for the most part going to be higher than our risk-based concentrations. This is a map put together by USGS that shows at a countywide level the average concentrations of arsenic in soils. And you can see that for the greater most of the area, we're at 5, and 20 is not unheard of, and sometimes it's even higher areas than that. And this is naturally occurring. Arsenic is part of the Earth's crust. And then in that box there, you can see we have listed just a couple examples of risk-based screening levels. We have the US EPA regional screening level, which is 0.68 milligrams per kilogram, and then California DTSC screening level, which is 0.11 milligrams per kilogram. It's important to note that both of those do take bioavailability into consideration already. They use the US EPA default of 60%. Now, it should be noted that that US EPA default is based off of some empirical data, but also should only be used in the absence of an ability to determine your own site-specific bioavailability. So it's a great screening tool, but if you're going to be making bioavailability adjustments on your site, you really want it to be coming up with your own value. So all of that being said, these risk-based screening levels are significantly lower than what the background typically is throughout the world. And so it's important to know that because particularly for residential cleanups, oftentimes it's going to be that background value that's used as a cleanup goal or for the sake of comparison. So those are some things to think about, Kevin, as we move through and learn more about your site.
Thanks, Riley. All right, so I do have a situation where I have potential human exposure. Soil ingestion is definitely a route that will be a factor. What I've got presented now is actually the soil concentrations that we were seeing from the investigation of the site. To your point, one of the pieces of information we gathered was some background concentrations from an area that was unaffected by past use. So we believe these levels to be generally consistent with naturally occurring arsenic levels. Just to kind of summarize what we see, we're basically seeing concentrations that are elevated relative to the background concentration that we're seeing. These are average concentrations in each of the fields, and obviously we see numbers that are in double-digit milligram per kilogram, but all the way as high as 2,000 milligrams per kilogram for averages within each of these units. So in conducting an initial risk analysis on these, we were able to basically calculate risks for residential and recreational exposure receptors that are at levels, in some cases, based upon the concentration we found, that are above risk management goals that we're going to need to use to make a decision about either remediation or other approaches for dealing with these levels. So, Valerie, what I did based on your previous slide, is this does account for a relative bioavailability of arsenic in soil of 60%, consistent with that default that you had mentioned on your previous slide. So with this right now, as it stands, we'll be looking to have to manage approximately, I think it's almost 70% of the site. You know, we're looking at approximately 160,000 tons of soil, which yields a cost of about $26 million worth of work. So there's a pretty sizable footprint, environmental footprint, for conducting this remediation. So I think as part of that, I might be interested in thinking about doing a site-specific bioavailability assessment. But before I do so, what might be the next thing I want to think about in terms of making that decision about whether to do more work to try to characterize site-specific relative bioavailability at this site?
So the next step in this decision process flowchart is a pretty simple one, right? Is there a method available? Because if there's not a method, then how can we proceed? Previously, as Yvette discussed earlier, you would have to use in vivo models. The juvenile swine has been used for years. Also, there's been a mouse model that was developed more recently, and then a monkey model that has existed before. And up until relatively recently, these kinds of studies were really necessary, but they were also very time-consuming and quite cost-ineffective. They cost quite a bit, and it would be a limiting factor for people to be able to actually look at bioavailability on their sites. But more recently, there have been a number of in vitro methods that have been developed, and some of those have regulatory acceptance. So US EPA method 1340, that was originally developed for lead, but it's been recently approved to be used with arsenic as well. California has their California arsenic bioaccessibility method, which was released in 2016. There's also the unified barge method, which is used throughout Europe. And then these couple of other methods, the in vitro gastrointestinal method and the PVET method, have been used for a long time to be able to look at sites and look at in vitro data. So there are a number of different methods that are available. It's quite important that you know what regulatory agency you're going to be working under. You know, in California, you would want to be using the California arsenic bioaccessibility method. And in other states, maybe they would want you to use the California method. Maybe they would want you to use US EPA. So it would be really important as you're planning to do this that you would talk to the regulatory agency involved and make sure that the method that you're going to be using is one that is indeed acceptable by them and for use in the state that you're in. And the second, so we know that there's a method, so that's not a problem. And then the next question is, could the bioavailability actually affect your remedial decision making? Because if it doesn't affect your decisions, then you know you're kind of spending money for no reason without getting any value out of it. Figure 7.3 from our guidance document, and this is a decision matrix to help you decide whether or not it might be a good idea to move forward. So our first question is arsenic greater than background levels? And I think you've already presented that, in fact, it is. And then we can look at what is the future land use, the potential future land use, versus the magnitude of arsenic in your soils. Because if you're looking for a residential land use, but you've got really, really high arsenic concentrations, like over 1,000 milligrams per kilogram, no matter what adjustment of bioavailability you get on that, it's likely that you're still going to have quite a bit of you're still going to have to do quite a bit of remediation. So that's an important consideration. Versus if you are going to be doing a recreational scenario, then oftentimes bioavailability, even on high concentration soils, it's possible that the bioavailability adjustment is going to allow those soils to be reused and have less cleanup involved. So this is just kind of a general guidance to help you decide, you know, whether or not you, how much you think you're really going to be able to get out of this kind of study. So what do you think, Kevin? Kevin?
I'm not hearing Kevin either, and I did hear somebody fall off the line, so let's let him know that perhaps we're not hearing him.
Well, I can go ahead and kind of walk through these and hopefully, is that Kevin rejoining us?
Sorry, guys. Yes. Sorry, buddy. That's my fault. Just for fun.
No problem.
Just to keep everybody awake. So really what's presented on this slide are looking at the concentrations that I talked about earlier in each area of the site relative to those levels that might help me think about whether there is a benefit or possible benefit to or opportunity for my remedy decision to be affected by accounting for relative bioavailability. So with regards to residential exposure, the color scheme that's shown here is actually consistent with what was in Valerie's slide. So portions of the site that are shown in red, I have a relatively low chance of having a significant change in my remedy decision or need to do some kind of risk management. Things that are yellow, a little bit of a fair chance, and those that are in green, I have a higher chance. With regards to recreational exposure, I see a much higher opportunity to have a significant change in my remedial decision. So I think based on this, Valerie, I'm looking at a situation where I do have conditions that might result in a different decision if I incorporate or work through a site-specific bioavailability assessment. What might be the next thing I should think about in terms of moving forward?
So the next thing is to do a cost-benefit analysis. You know, do the benefits of doing a bioavailability adjustment justify the cost? You know, I do want to preface this with one of the main reasons we do these bioavailability studies is to refine the risk assessment to get more site-specific data, and it's really a science-based value. But we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the cost-benefit part of it, because that is a big part, and that's what's going to, you know, encourage responsible parties to want to go forward with these kinds of evaluations and spend this money. So while we're maintaining a same risk, you know, level goal, it is important to look at the cost. And so that's one of the next steps, and we have a whole section in our document about how to do these cost-benefit analyses. So we have a poll question here. How much do you think an in vitro bioavailability study would cost for this site? I'll give you a little bit of time to answer this question. So it looks like most people are ringing in right about the $20,000 range. Okay, we've got about 75% ringing in with that. So let's go ahead and take a look. So this is a table from the guidance document, and this is very general about the cost that it's going to be for different tests that you would want to do. Now, it's important to know that these tests for, say, lead and arsenic are typically much less expensive than they would be for something like PAHs. You can see that in the in vivo section, those methods, you know, I recently or earlier said that in vivo used to be the way you always had to go. And those ran about $20,000 to $30,000 per sample, sometimes even, or per study, sometimes even more. You know, the swine studies were looking at $75,000 for a study, quite expensive, versus doing the in vitro bioaccessibility, we're looking at potentially only $200 to $1,000 per sample. Of course, there's also the cost of putting together the reports and all of that goes along with it. But you can see these are the general costs associated with conducting a bioavailability study. So, Kevin, what do you think? We've got all this information.
Yeah, I think actually if I were to pull the trigger on this and work through it, you know, maybe collecting a single sample from each of these areas. I mean, I have soil that's relatively homogeneous across the site. And so, you know, I should, based upon that, get reasonably consistent results. At least that would be my hypothesis. So what I've done here is I've just selected locations that exhibited the highest arsenic concentrations in each of these areas. And I think if we do that, we're looking at nothing more than about, you know, 10 to 20 grand of actual work to characterize site-specific relative bioavailability generally at this site. So I guess with that, I'm feeling pretty good about the potential benefit that this might have in reducing the overall footprint and increase the sustainability of my actual remedial action. If I were to do this, is there any other thing that I should think about before moving forward with it? Are there any other factors that you would encourage me to consider?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, it's really important that people don't feel like these studies are just being done to save money or to leave contamination in place. They really are a refinement of the risk assessment. You know, we do this all the time in risk assessment, where we look at the specific exposures and parameters that are involved in on a case-by-case basis. And communicating that and gaining the respect and trust of the community, the public, is really important. Again, regulatory constraints, you want to make sure that you've spoken to whatever regulatory agency it is that would be overseeing your work or having to approve your work, and make sure that you're using the method that they're okay with. And in some states, this is going to be very new, and it might be, you know, you're going to need to really explain to them what bioavailability is about and encourage them to take an ITRT training or to look at our guidance document. So those are important things. And then, of course, all the logistical constraints about doing the sampling, finding a lab that can run the analysis, all of those kinds of things that we think about with any kind of evaluation are still on the table when it comes to this kind of evaluation. So what do you think, Kevin?
All right. Well, I think we're going to do it, and because everybody's chomping at the bit. What we end up getting are in vitro bioaccessibility values that ranged between 31 and 43%. That gives us a mean of about 36%, and an upper confidence limit on that mean is approximately 39%. So now this is an IVBA number value. Is that the value I should plug into my risk calculations?
Good question, Kevin. So Yvette presented a figure like this earlier. This is the IVIVC for the California Arsenic Bioaccessibility Method. And this is just showing you that what you would do here is you would take your 39% that you've got for the IVBA, and you'd plug it into this regression equation, and that would show you that the RBA is 35%. And it's that 35% that you would then go and take to put into these calculations here. On the left is the cancer risk calculation, and on the right is the hazard, the non-cancer hazard calculation. So you would want to use the regression equation for your specific method. Now, again, I just showed the CAB method, assuming that's the method that you're using, but you would use whatever regression equation existed for the method that you were going to use.
Excellent. So based upon that, and using that 35% RBA, we went ahead and updated the risk calculations for both residential and recreational user exposures. And what we end up with is a significant change in our outcome. We're actually looking at approximately a 50% reduction in the amount of material that we'll have to manage before moving forward with the redevelopment. It's approximately $16 million in savings. And so there's a lot less material that we'll have to remove from the site and dispose of, say, in a landfill or whatnot. So I think we've seen a substantial improvement in the outcome here. And more importantly, I think we now have a risk assessment that we can be comfortable with, but just by simply reducing some of the uncertainty in it by incorporating site-specific relative bioavailability. So I think with that, I think we're going to turn it back over to Juliana so that we can have a little bit of a Q&A at this point.
Thank you. Everyone in the phone line or in the audience is welcome to send in a question using the Q&A in the bottom right. For our phone line participants, if you'd like to, it's #6 to unmute your phone and ask a question out loud. I'll also remind everyone, at the end of the training class, we are looking for your feedback. So if you have to leave before we wrap up, in the middle right, those related links, you may need to scroll down to see feedback. It's second to last. You select feedback, look down a bit, select browse to. That's going to allow that feedback form to open in a new window. We really do use your feedback, and it's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for attending today's class. So a question came in, and this is for Valerie and Kevin's case study. Did you consider phytoremediation options for arsenic contamination at this site?
Go ahead, Kevin. I was going to say, of course, this is a completely completely fictitious site, phytoremediation may be something that's useful. Of course, phytoremediation is something that's studied quite a bit. Of course, then you have to figure out what to do with those plants, and there's the time that's involved in planting and actually having the remediation take place and all of that. But that's certainly something that could be considered, but it doesn't fall under something that we've discussed in our guidance document or that we considered in this fictional case study.
And this is Juliana. I will mention that ITRC does have a great document on phytoremediation. So on the ITRC website, itrcweb.org, you're welcome to look through the guidance document section to find that resource. We have a couple of questions about labs. You mentioned needing labs that conduct this work. Is this type of analysis widely available? And is there a list of labs that do the in vitro analysis in the resource section of the guidance?
So the in vitro, was the question about in vivo or in vitro? I think both. The in vitro methods, I will say, there are a number of labs that are able to run these. These are methods, especially for lead, that have been around for quite a long time. I'll say I'm in California myself. I work with DTSC, and our CAB method, which is relatively new, we have a list of labs that we recognize that have successfully set up this method and that we're comfortable with being used, and that's listed in our guidance document, which is referenced in the ITRC guidance document. But for the most part, they're not overly complex methods that need to be done. So particularly for lead and arsenic, so there are a lot of labs that can do them. And like I said, the lead method, which has now also been approved for arsenic from US EPA, has been around for quite some time. So there are quite a number of labs that are able to do it. So it shouldn't be too difficult to locate one that you could send samples to.
Right. I might add that the lead and arsenic methods from EPA are an established EPA method, and so they can be found, and labs can document that they have followed those methods.
What are the major differences between the 2017 US EPA bioavailability document and the 2016 DTSC guidance?
Well, the main difference is that they recommend two different methods. So the US EPA, the one, recommends the method 1340 that we've discussed that was initially developed for use in lead, and they've proven out through numerous studies that it is also able to be used for arsenic. For the California one, we developed the California Arsenic Bioaccessibility Method. The development of that method was taking place before US EPA had determined that 1340 was acceptable for use in for arsenic as well. So there are two different in vitro methods. In California, we saw our method worked a little bit better for the soils that we were evaluating. We're a little bit closer in predicting what was seen in the in vivo studies, but both of them are good methods that that give quality results, and it's just different recommendations from different organizations.
For arsenic, what is the factor that has the greatest impact on bioavailability?
Well, iron is kind of one of the biggest things. So we know one of the big why bioavailability in soils is reduced in soils is because it binds with other minerals, other compounds, and it makes it so that arsenic isn't available to be absorbed, readily absorbed. And iron is the number one thing that really will drive arsenic bioavailability down. But there's a lot more nuances to it. So you can't just look at the concentration of arsenic in your soils and predict that what your bioavailability of arsenic would be. Although, if you have high iron content soils, that's a pretty good indication that it's likely that your bioavailability of arsenic in those soils is going to be on the lower end of the scale. And that could just be one piece of information that you might use to help you decide whether or not you wanted to conduct one of these studies.
How would you expect bioavailability to change over time, as far as changes in the soil over time? If a remedy is protective now, will it still be protective 20 years from now?
There's actually a section in the guidance that deals with this and kind of covers this possibility. I think overall, the general expectation is that the most amendments to soil, things that might happen, would actually most likely reduce the bioavailability. There are a couple of situations when I think that might not be the case. But overall, most of the changes would likely end up reducing the bioavailability, if at all. But anyway, there's a nice short section on things that could potentially affect the bioavailability over time, and what might lead to that. So there are even technologies that might be out there for remedy that look to try to, through reducing bioavailability, achieve a more protective situation. So that in terms of a remedial action, reducing bioavailability is actually one of the things that you could potentially consider.
Is information available on which states have adopted which or what methods, the 1340 or not?
Well, 1340 is a US EPA method. I don't know that we have, so a number of states likely would use it. This is relatively new. We did do a survey when we were first starting this project, which was almost 3 years ago now, a little over 3 years ago, where we did a survey of the state assessors group to ask which states were already looking at bioavailability. And so we do have that information listed in the guidance document, so you can see what states responded to that and what states are using it and aren't using it. However, again, that was 3 years ago. That was actually before 1340 was even approved for arsenic. And like I said, it's been used for quite some time in lead. So really, I don't think we have a running tally of states that are using or not using it. And this is new. So I think as we continue to do these trainings, people are going to be more and more comfortable. I know in California, we're starting to see these evaluations, very frequently. They're coming up quite a bit. And so I would hope that that would be happening across the country. But Yvette's been involved in these bioavailability studies throughout the country, I think, for a number of years. So they've been going for a long time. But in some cases, it might be necessary to introduce your state to this concept and let them know that this guidance document is out and try to help educate them on why and how it is useful.
Yeah. This is Yvette. Just to build on that, what Valerie said is exactly right. The risk assessment guidance has allowed for bioavailability adjustments for decades and decades. The goal of this ITRC committee and the guidance document was to get the word out. Bioavailability adjustments are becoming more and more commonly accepted in risk assessments, and our goal is just to make sure state regulators have a tool that they can use to feel comfortable that they understand that this isn't just hand-waving and that there are technical merits and a strong scientific basis for it. So every state conceptually accepts. We just need to have more and more precedents.
Thank you. We do have more questions, and trainers, as you have time to answer those questions, and be sure to respond privately to those questions that haven't been answered yet, but we're going to continue on with the second half of the training. Participants, you're welcome to keep sending in questions, and we will get to as many as we can at the end of today's training class. For now, we're going to continue on, and I'm going to turn it over to Bryn Toms at the Oregon DEQ and Anita Meyer at the U.S. Army Corps.
Thanks, Juliana. And thanks, Kevin and Valerie, for that case study. So this case study, we're going to do another case study just like theirs, but it's specific to lead. And the reason it's specific to lead is that there's a handful of different ways of sampling, and there's some methods out there that have already been presented that we should be following for that. And there's also the IUBK model, which is a different way of looking at risk than many other contaminants. So that's why we're going to do this specific one. So the way this is going to be set up, it's fictitious, but it's going to be set up as a series of two meetings between a regulator, that'll be myself, and a consultant who will be Anita. And what we'll do is kind of walk through what we know about this particular site and then discuss the options with either remediation or removal of contaminated material or actually doing a bioavailability study. And you folks on the phone, you're going to get poll questions, and what you can pretend to be is the regulator. Pretend that you're the regulatory team helping me out on these questions. So we'll start off. This is essentially a historic lead mining site, and the contaminant is lead tailings, and it's spread across an area that now has residential development on it. It also has the potential for commercial development. So the picture on the left is an old air photo, 1940s, and the scarred areas are essentially the mine tailings, very common sort of mine site. The specific site we're talking about is going to be a 3-acre parcel that's on top of this, and the mining ceased in the 60s. And then the residential development moved in the 80s over the top of this, and this isn't really that uncommon. So this is a picture of what the residential area looks like now. We're going to take a look at specifically 10 properties here, and as you can see, these are somewhat larger yards than you might have nowadays, but it's a 1980s development. And the sites or the property parcels themselves are going to be about a third acre in size or smaller. They include play areas and gardens. And each yard has a front yard, a backyard, two side yards. And the reason I'm emphasizing all that is because in the Lead Contaminated Residential Sites Handbook, with the URL at the bottom there of this slide, it goes into detail on how you collect your lead samples for understanding the total lead. This is before we do bioavailability, by the way. So what we know about the site right now is that there are a handful of samples collected. The yellow dots represent composite samples for each of the front yards, backyard, side yards. The discrete samples are represented by the orange, and they are specific to play areas and gardens. And so what we have for a data set right now for total lead is about 40 samples are composite, and about 15 samples are discrete. And the concentrations of lead range from 380 to 1,321 milligrams per kilogram, with an arithmetic mean of about 850 milligrams per kilogram, with low standard deviation, so that kind of fits right in the middle there. And the background around this area is 30 milligrams per kilogram, and that's important to, as Valerie pointed out, the background is important to look at and be aware of. So as you can imagine, the soil type is a well-graded gravel. This is tailings, but over the years, imported fill has been put on top. So it's a small layer, thin layer of fines that are used for the lawns and that sort of thing. So here we can see the distribution of those concentrations. And if we were to use a screening level of 400 milligrams per kilogram, essentially most of this site would need either remediation or further assessment. And I will caveat that number. I know a lot of states now are moving towards something closer to 200 milligrams per kilogram for a screening value. As the blood lead level targets are changing, we're going to see lower and lower numbers. So just keep that in mind that we used that number when we developed this thing about a year ago, and we've been using it ever since in this case study. So what we know is that there is a fair amount of excavation that might have to take place if we use that default screening value. And the cost would be about $700,000 to do all this. It would be a big disruption to the residents, and it would take a few weeks to do. And so what we're sitting here in the meeting doing is discussing some options here about what we might look forward to. So Anita, I'm going to turn it over to you, and you can kind of tell us what your thoughts are on doing a bioavailability study.
Thanks, Bryn, and I'm looking forward to working with you and your team on this project. So what, you know, we have acknowledged that we're going to have to clean up most all of the site if we go with the Oregon default cleanup level. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use this flow chart to determine whether a bioavailability study is worthwhile. I'm going to go in and zoom in closer on that. And we know that ingestion of lead is the main pathway of concern at the site. And soil ingestion is the medium and pathway of concern. So what we need to do is determine whether or not there is a method available to look at bioavailability, and there is. And then we're also going to look at whether bioavailability might affect the remedial decision. So there is a method available. It is method 1340 for measuring bioaccessibility of lead in soil. And as we learned earlier, bioaccessibility is a measure of what might be released from the ingested soil into the stomach. Like if we had larger chunks of soil that were being ingested, those probably wouldn't be as bioaccessible for lead, but it's what would get from the soil and into the gastric juices. And we believe that using this method will be sufficient for our soils. This site has been well characterized. We know that there's a good correlation between in vivo methods for studying lead to in vitro methods, such as method 1340. And the type of soil at our site is similar to what was used by EPA in testing this method and other sites that it's been used on. So we think that this will be a good method for us to use. But also, will it matter at the site? Are the concentrations at this site at a level that it might actually make a difference to use a bioavailability study? And the concentrations of our soils range from about 400 to 2,000 milligrams per kilogram. And if you look at this chart, that is right in the green area that says that there's a high likelihood that our decisions might be affected by using a bioavailability study. Now we know that we can, it could affect a decision, but will it be really worth it? We need to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if it's going to be worth our time and resources to conduct a bioavailability study at the site. And this is in the flowchart as well. And what you need to consider, what we're going to consider when we're looking at the cost-benefit analysis is all the elements that go into the study. We're going to have to write a work plan, develop a draft, have it reviewed, make another final version of it. We're going to have coordination with the agency and also all those stakeholders that live on the site and people that might also live adjacent in the neighborhood and be concerned. So we'll probably have to have some meetings with them before we go in and do further sampling. That coordination needs to be accounted for when we're doing a cost estimate. And then sample collection and analysis, the efforts of calculating site-specific cleanup levels from the data. Before we collect the data, we would need to do verify our laboratory and the data that we get back before we use it. So all of those go into developing a cost estimate to determine whether it's worth our resources to do the bioavailability study. And what we did is when we looked at this, we determined, yeah, it's probably going to be worth our while to do the study. But we need to know now, we're going to go in and take some more samples at the site using EPA guidance, but we need to know how many we need to collect. And can you help me, Bryn, and Bryn's team to figure that out?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that background. It really looks like the bioavailability study would be potentially worthwhile, and I think it's important that you pointed out those other aspects with work plan development and some of the costs that might be associated with it. So with regards to collecting samples at the site, we've kind of gone over this a few times at our agency, and I'm going to put a question out here to our folks. And you guys are on the phone, you're the regulatory team here. How many samples should be collected for bioavailability testing, not including duplicate samples at this 3-acre site? And remember, we have a good understanding of nature and extent already, which we presented at the very beginning. And this question is really more for illustrating that there is going to be back and forth with the regulatory agency and discussions on how you go about collecting samples and what you're going to do with that information in a bioavailability study. So this is really more about that. This could be specific to any other. I mean, it could change per site. And I should emphasize that different states might have different ways of deciding how you pick the number of samples. And what we're seeing is kind of what I expected, that folks are kind of leaning towards, about three-quarters of you are leaning towards considering each one of these parcels a decision unit, so 10 incremental samples across 3 acres. And I think that's a good point. What we've considered in some discussion with the consultant is that we're willing to compromise and go to down to 2 incremental samples across the site, and that is because it's homogeneous material, homogeneous thickness, and we feel like that'll be a pretty good representative data set. So, Anita, I want to bring up a couple things before you guys go off and kind of work on this work plan. One of the things, as we just kind of talked about there, is this idea of ISM, incremental sampling methodology. The guidance document from 2015 from the EPA that looked at sample collection for in vitro analysis for lead talks about these types of compositing sampling methodologies. And what I'd like to emphasize is that the ITRC ISM guidance fits nicely with that guidance document. And essentially what we're looking for is equal representation of volume and depth from all increments. And I believe what we stated before with 2 decision units with 30 increments in triplicate would be a good representative data set. And that's demonstrated here with this figure we're looking at with the 2 ranges in these decision units. They're fairly similar. And I think we're in agreement that we can go with that method. I mean, that amount of ISM samples. So another thing to think of or remember is that recently the EPA changed their sieving guidance for lead sites, at least for incidental ingestion. It's now looking at 150 microns. So everything below that number essentially appears to be more in line with what folks have been seeing lately in IVBA studies with regards to what sticks to the hands and objects that might be ingested. So that's something to consider when you develop your work plan. And so what you're saying essentially in this meeting right now is that if you were to go out and excavate this site, you'd be looking at digging up the whole thing at a cost of $700,000 and a fair amount of disruption to the neighborhood. And you're saying that after a bioavailability study, you might find that the bioavailability would be lower than our default values. And if it were in the range of 20 or 30%, we're just kind of guesstimating at this point, you may end up having no requirement for excavation. And you're saying that that cost of that study would be about, I think you said $30,000, and that has to do with work plan development, sampling analysis, and reporting. And I'll emphasize that there could be some back and forth with our agency to make sure that everybody's on the right page and in agreement with this. And the important part is that you're saying that the remedy would still be protective. So one of the things I want to emphasize, and this is similar to what Valerie emphasized in that previous case study, but one of the things to emphasize is at the bottom of our decision process flowchart are these other considerations. And I won't get into the details or examples on some of these other ones, but I will emphasize on the public acceptance part is that we already have talked to the neighbors and residents about this 400 milligram per kilogram screening value. And if we go out there and tell them that there's going to be a higher screening value, they're going to have a lot of questions. And I think we need to prepare a plain language fact sheet that talks about that number, talks about bioavailability and those concepts so that they can understand and accept what we're talking about, because we certainly don't want to go out there and confuse and obfuscate. That shouldn't happen. Another thing to consider on the regulatory constraint side is that our sister health agency does have sort of a different perspective on the bioavailability. So we need to make sure we have some communication with them early on. So to summarize our first meeting, what we found out was we know what we have for a lead data set. And the consultant is planning to go forth with a bioavailability assessment. They're going to follow the 1340 method, divide the site into two decision units. They're going to follow the ISM guidance. And then they're going to calculate site-specific cleanup values using those results. And so what we'll do is cut them loose, and we're going to fast forward now to the second meeting. So it's been a few months, and now we're going to have the second meeting between the regulator and the consultant. And what they've done is they've developed a work plan. There was definitely some back and forth on that. And then they went and collected samples for the bioavailability study. They got the results back. And now before they develop or finalize a report, they're going to have this meeting with us, and we're all going to sit down and discuss the results. So, Anita, what did you guys find out?
Well, so you cut us loose to go to the site and take samples, do the laboratory analysis, and we're happy to report back what we found. We found ranges of in vitro bioaccessibility, looking here on the right side, from about 16 to 19% in one decision unit, and in the other decision unit on the left, it ranged from about 16 again to 17%. But what we had to do was we need to predict relative bioavailability using that data in order to use it in our lead models to get back to a soil concentration. And so we used the linear regression model that was developed by EPA for converting these numbers for lead, and we get relative bioavailability in one decision unit that range from 14 to 17%. And in the other one on the left, 14 to 15%. And we also looked at how much the absolute bioavailability was. We converted that from the relative bioavailability, and that is an estimate of the fraction of the ingested dose that actually crosses a membrane and gets into the bloodstream and then, you know, able to circulate around the body. And we got in the area of 7 to 8.5% absolute bioavailability. So now we have these ranges of relative bioavailability. So what values do we need to use in our lead models to make get our soil concentration levels?
Well, that's a really good question, Nina. Thanks for asking. This is a poll question for the regulatory team out there. Which RBA percent would you use? Would you use the maximum of six values? Would you use the average of six values? Or would you use the higher 95% UCLL on the mean of the two triplicate samples, which is 16.5%? And, again, this question is, again, to illustrate that there needs to be some discussion early on with the regulatory agency about what you're going to define or how you're going to use the results. In this particular case, this was determined in the work plan. We already worked on this and discussed what we were going to use. And I see in the poll answers that about 75% are saying the higher 95% UCL, and about 20% are saying the maximum six values. And I don't think there's really necessarily any right answer, but what I would like to emphasize is that the regulatory agency you're working with may have a specific way of doing this. And I know that a lot of states use the 95% UCL on the mean often in a lot of risk assessment calculations. So that's what we would recommend, Anita.
Okay, so we're going to use 16.5% in our model. And there's two different models that are available for assessing risk of lead. One is the integrated exposure uptake biokinetic model, which is used for on residential sites for assessing exposure that the children have to lead in soil. And then also there's another model for the adult lead methodology where it's not children that are being exposed, but it's adults being exposed, and then the protected entity then is an unborn child. So what we're going to use instead of the default is 16.5%, which is our site-specific value. And the ITRC guidance document discusses the methodology of how to do that. And what we believe is we're really going to have some reduced uncertainty at this site using a site-specific level. Okay. So there is some, Bryn mentioned earlier, some new guidance on particle size for use in the lead models. But also there have been additional changes that have been recommended by EPA for the baseline blood lead values that are used in these. They're basically pharmacokinetic models. And it's good news that the changes that they have noticed in the population, we have less blood lead in our blood than we used to in the population as a whole. And that's thanks to, you know, reductions that have been made by regulations over the years. One of them, probably a huge one, is the use of unleaded gasoline. But also, when EPA released some of these guidance documents, you know, noting changes that need to be made in assessing lead, they've also noted that we see, you know, adverse effects when blood lead concentrations are even below 10 micrograms per deciliter. And so what we did for our site is we used the 5 micrograms per deciliter blood lead target value to estimate soil cleanup levels, and then we're comparing that to the state default cleanup level of 400 milligrams per kilogram, which again has that higher assumed relative bioavailability to get the equivalent to 10 micrograms per deciliter. So even using 5 micrograms per deciliter as our target, and with our site-specific value of 16.5%, we have a 75% reduction in areas that would require remediation. We also ran the lead model, the adult lead model, to develop a cleanup level for commercial property. And we did this because we wanted to make sure what type of liability that we might have if the land use were to change in the future. And under a commercial scenario, our site-specific cleanup level is 3,800 milligrams per kilogram, and that's based on that lower blood lead target of 5 micrograms per deciliter. And the state default value is 800 milligrams per kilogram, so we're much higher. And for commercial land use, no remediation would be required at all. And no institutional controls would be needed either. So it's good to know the future of the land. We would have no liability and no need to control the use for a changing beyond residential.
Wow, that's really good information. Thanks a lot, Anita. I understand that there is potential commercial development in the future in this area, so the residents might give some folks some options out there. So I'm going to sum up this case study with a few things. What we found, first off, is that a lot of this information that Anita just presented is similar to some of the more recent bioavailability studies we've been looking at, and I think we're all in line. And with all of the work plan development, I think we have a good path forward. So what we found here is that by doing this bioavailability assessment, what we found is it reduces the uncertainty in the site risks and the risk-based cleanup. It's going to reduce the disruption to the residents in the area, and it'll reduce the remediation-related risks, so truck traffic, burning greenhouse gases, tree damage, damage to the properties, and it reduces remediation costs, and I'm sure that the responsible party is happy with that. But it also provides site-specific data that helps supplement the nature and extent of sampling. So we even have more information about the site now and have more confidence in the data set that we're looking at. It also provides decisions that are still protective of human health. And that's because we're going after that same target risk level. and it also provides some flexibility in remedial options. And what we also found is that stakeholder outreach in this specific case study, stakeholder outreach is going to be very important. As I emphasized, that's going to be a big part of this. And there, we may find that there may be a lot of public meetings or a lot of discussion that may raise the costs to some extent for the consultant and all that. and the response party, but it is going to be a necessary part of this, and that's why early outreach with good and good plain language is going to be important on this one. So thanks a lot, Anita. I'm going to turn it over now to Valerie, and she's going to to Yvette Lowney, technical advisor to CERTIP, and she's going to present a discussion on PAHs.
Thanks, Bryn, and thanks for the case study. That was interesting. I'm going to touch, so until now, the focus of the presentations have really been on lead and arsenic. As I mentioned before, the concepts we're communicating apply to any chemicals, and one of the other chemicals or classes of chemicals that have been studied quite a bit for bioavailability are PAHs, so polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and we're presenting them separately because they're different than the metals that we've talked about so far. So PAHs are a class of chemicals with over 10,000 individual chemicals in that class. Seven of them are currently considered by EPA to be carcinogenic, and they can be of different ring sizes. So these are organic chemicals with carbon rings. And over on the left-hand side of the slide, you can see some examples of the different individual PAHs. They're different than metals in that they have very low water solubility, and they're lipophilic. They also have, those that we're concerned about also have low vapor pressure, and those are the ones that remain in the soil or might remain in the soil and require soil remediation after a risk assessment. So there are numerous sources of PAHs in soil. So PAHs are formed by the pyrolysis of carbon forms. So combustion of organic matter, and they can also be produced geologically and are present in things like fossil fuels, coal, and oil. So they form from natural processes like forest fires and volcanic eruptions. They form from industrial processes, and many of them are listed here in the slide. And there are also non-industrial sources. Such as urban asphalt sealants, landfills, and open burning or fire trainings. So we're going to talk about PAHs because they are among the most common chemicals of concern at contaminated sites. Current regulatory default is to assume that the relative oral bioavailability of PAHs is 100%. And I probably should have hammered on this a little bit more in the earlier presentation I gave. What that means is that the absorption of PAHs from soil is equivalent to the absorption of PAH-spiked food, because for PAHs, the toxicology, the toxicity values, such as the cancer slope factor and RFDs, are based on studies with PAH-spiked food. An RBA of 100% doesn't necessarily mean that we're assuming that it is 100% absorbed. It just means that we're assuming that it is absorbed as well as the PAHs in the toxicity studies. So you can imagine, given the diversity of sources of PAHs to the environment, and particularly industrial PAHs, there's considerable interest in incorporating bioavailability adjustments into human health risk assessments. Over the last several decades, there have been over 60 studies performed looking at either in vivo studies of bioavailability or in vitro studies of bioaccessibility for PAHs in soil. And that doesn't even include an extensive literature looking at PAH bioavailability in sediments. Together, these studies have supported site-specific bioavailability values for use in risk assessment. What they are showing us is that they are helping us understand what are the factors that are controlling the binding of PAHs to soil. Unfortunately, even given this large library of information, there's still no consensus on a perfect in vitro method or even an acceptable in vitro method or even the best in vivo methods for estimating bioavailability. So bioavailability of organics from soil has lagged behind metals such as lead and arsenic. And the reason for that is that studying the bioavailability of organic chemicals is harder than metals. As I indicated before, it's a chemical mixture. The analytical costs are quite high. So for lead and arsenic, you can get your soils analyzed for, you know, $10 to $20 per sample. The analytical costs for PAHs are at least an order of magnitude higher than that. The animal work to understand bioavailability is more complicated. Lead and arsenic are elements. So you feed lead and arsenic in whatever form you have it at your site, and then you allow it to go through your animal model and you measure for lead or arsenic. For organic chemicals, there's metabolism. So if you administer benzopyrene, it gets metabolized in the gut as soon as it gets absorbed from the gut. And so if you're only looking for the parent compound of benzopyrene in either the urine or the blood, you're going to come up with an inappropriate number for estimating bioavailability. So again, there's metabolism in the liver, in the target tissues where you're measuring it. There's microbial metabolism in the gut. And there are all sorts of different metabolites. And so it's not a simple thing to identify a measurement endpoint when you're looking at organic chemicals. You will not be quizzed on enterohepatic recirculation. It's just kind of fun to say. But that's an issue where some of the PAHs are absorbed. They go through the intestines into the liver, where they then get excreted. They go into the bile and then excreted back into the intestine. And so there's this circular metabolism. And so that obviously makes it very complicated to estimate bioavailability. And then in terms of in vitro methods for estimating bioavailability, even the in vitro methods require a more complicated analysis. For lead and arsenic, the IVBA methods simulate a gastric environment where the acid dissolution is what appears to be controlling the binding of the metals to the soil. Whereas for organic chemicals, you need to simulate not only a gastric but also an intestinal environment, because the components of that intestinal environment are what are affecting the bioavailability from soil. So what do we know from all of this? The ITRC document gives a very detailed background on what we know about the toxicology and the bioavailability research for PAHs. It talks about what we know about appropriate soil particle size. These are things that you might want to consider if you have a large site and you want to generate some for an RBA assessment, your risk, RBA incorporation into your risk assessment. So are you including the appropriate soil particle size? Does the study include a relevant comparison group? Are all the appropriate controls included in there? Your researcher should be able to talk about pharmacokinetics. So PAHs and other organic chemicals are metabolized, but they also induce the enzymes that metabolize them. So that has to be addressed. We could do a whole two-hour lecture on that topic alone. But it goes to the issue of, do you want to use a repeated dose versus a single dose? A repeated dose will cause induction of those enzymes, whereas a single dose might not. What's your measurement endpoint? Are you looking at the parent compound? Are you looking at metabolites? Are you looking at both? And do you have an adequate number of study subjects? Do you have the power to form strong conclusions? What are the concentrations and doses that have been administered in the study? The PAH literature is definitely full of studies that have been done at concentrations of PAHs in soil where a bioavailability adjustment would not help you change your decision about whether remediation is needed. So studies at high concentrations may not be relevant for how the soil-chemical interactions occur and how bioavailability is controlled at the low concentrations that are relevant for where we could be using bioavailability adjustments in the risk assessment. A good study should be able to demonstrate the full range of bioavailability from low to high. And you might want to question whether or not you're using average values versus lots of data and individual subjects being reported. And a good study to do a mass balance. So what was the dose that you put in and where did it go? Not just you recovered 0.02% of something and you're doing a bioavailability adjustment based on that, but where did the rest of it go and how do we know that wasn't absorbed? Other key considerations, and again, we don't really expect you guys to know this. It's all included in the ITRC document because these are things you might be wanting to ask the people who would be doing a study and to give you the tools that you need to ask questions if you are tasked with reviewing a study. Other key considerations are sources, what is the toxicity, factors influencing information, the bioavailability from soil, what are the current in vivo and in vitro methods that are known, what do we know from that research that's been conducted to date, and what are considerations for dermal absorption? So PAHs can also be absorbed through the skin. How does that fit into your risk assessment, and how would bioavailability considerations be important there? So all of these things are discussed in the PAH document, in the ITRC document, and as well as a case study. So what we know about PAHs in soil. So the available studies are very clear at showing us that the source of PAHs to soil dominates how the PAHs are then bound to the soil. So PAHs are not introduced to the environment as individual PAHs. They come with their substrate. They are present in skeet or in fuel oil or in soot. And that source is really controlling on the bioavailability. Some sources of PAHs to the environment clearly have higher bioavailabilities and other show consistent and significantly lower bioavailability. For example, soot, skeet, and pitch, if introduced to soils, show lower bioavailability in those soils. If your source of PAHs to the soil are fuel oil or non-aqueous phase liquids, the literature indicates that those would be expected to have higher bioavailability. Soil characteristics can affect bioavailability, such as the peat, the organic content, the clay content, but those are less important than the source. The literature also is very clear that addition of charcoal to soil reduces bioavailability, and that can be important because you may have a site that has soil characteristics with lots of black carbon, or it might be useful in the future for looking at remediation, in situ remediation opportunities. We also know that the dermal pathway is important to be calculated in assessing exposures, and that there's a lot of work still to be done. And the good news is this work is still being done. So this is an area of emerging research. And now that you guys are all experts in bioavailability assessments for soil, you can watch for that with glee. This is the last slide on the PAH section. And this is a schematic from a 2016 publication by Ruby et al. And it is just capturing the things that we just walked through. So this is a schematic of soil in the middle with the different mineral phases and the different organic phases, and then showing the sources that might be introduced to the soil and how those sources might be really dominated by very slowly desorbing PAHs. Slowly desorbing meaning they're happy to stay stuck on the soil or on the source material. Or they might be dominated by very quickly desorbing PAHs, or they might be dominated by a mixture of those things. So with that, I am going to hand this over to back to Valerie, who will talk about sort of paths forward and how to think about incorporating adjustments and what tools are in the document for you to use.
Great, thanks so much, Yvette. So we've learned a lot today, right? So we're going to go ahead and do a little bit of an overview. Also just show you where you can get more information. This is the front page of our online document, the ITRC Bioavailability and Contaminated Soils guidance document shows here. This is going to just be an overview of the different sections you can see and how to navigate it. So you'll see on the left, there's a panel. It shows each section. As you click through, I'll just show you the different sections we have. We have the introductions. That has all the definitions and the theories about bioavailability, relative bioavailability versus absolute bioavailability, all of these terms that we've introduced today. There's a chapter on regulatory background, the existing guidance documents, the state acceptance, that's back to the poll information that I discussed earlier that was taken when we first started this process a few years ago. We have the technical background information on soil science and mineralogy, how those things play into bioavailability. We have the section decision process that has that decision tree that I went through in case study one and that Bryn referred to in case study two, and also that cost-benefit analysis information. We have a section on methodology. This goes into in vivo, in vitro, and then the in vivo, in vitro correlation. So this talks about the different methods, how these methods are developed, what's important, what's needed. That in vivo, in vitro correlation is very important. You can't just go in and use these in vitro methods without having them already been proved out in an in vivo method and knowing that the in vitro method does in fact predict what we see in vivo with one of these good correlations. That was a question we got previously about some other metals that maybe the methods aren't approved for yet. You'd want to make sure that you tested it out in both in vivo and in vitro. So those kinds of things are discussed in the methodology chapter. We then have our chemical specific chapters on lead, arsenic, and PAHs. They're put together very similarly, and they go through, you know, all of the unique challenges that exist with each one with lead. Like we just heard in case study two, arsenic as we heard in case study one, and the PAH discussion like Yvette just went over for us. We then have a section on risk assessment. So once you get this information, how do you then incorporate it into your human health risk assessment? We talk all about that in that chapter. And there's a chapter on stakeholder perspective, how to go through doing this engagement outreach, the communication that you need to have, how you present this to the public so that you gain trust and that people realize that it's not just about saving money, because that's absolutely not. It's really a refinement of the risk assessment based on scientific data. And then finally, we have a case studies section of the document. The bottom here is just showing you what the there's a table, and those are the headings from the table. So you can go and you can find your contaminant of concern that you're interested in and look and see if we have a case study where the soil type and the source type is similar. So let's say you've got high iron content soils from a gold mining study in Colorado and you're looking at arsenic, right? Maybe we have one that fits exactly with that. And you can see what's been done on other sites. Now, it's important to remember most of those case studies were done prior to this guidance being out. So they don't necessarily have recommendations by ITRC, but it shows you how they've been applied previously. This is another figure from our document, and it is a little complex, but it has some interesting information here. And what it's really looking at is looking at two different sites. Site A has a log normal distribution of the contamination, and site B has a linear distribution of the contamination. Now, both of them have a maximum concentration of 2,000 milligrams per kilogram, and the cleanup level that was set for this for this example, we aren't assigning it any particular compound, is 100 milligrams per kilogram, and that was assumed with an RBA of 100% bioavailability. And then what we've done is we're looking at here to see what about if the RBA was 20%? How does that impact the amount of soil that it has been contaminated and how much you would have to be cleaning up? Now, on site A, only 15% of the total contaminated soil would require remediation only 15% of the total soil has a concentration above 500 milligrams per kilogram. Now, that's our new adjusted cleanup value based off a 20% RBA. Versus over here on site B, 75% of the total volume would still require remediation with an RBA of 20%. So when you're figuring out whether or not a bioavailability study could be useful for your site and have big impacts on the amount you clean up, your distribution of your contamination is an important consideration. Another thing that we can gain from this figure is the idea that the cleanup levels increase significantly as the RBA values are 25% or less. So at 60%, that default RBA, it really doesn't buy you, if you will use that word, that much. It's about a 1.67% times higher cleanup level. Versus if you've got an RBA of 25%, you end up with a cleanup level that's about 4 times higher, and an RBA of 10% is a cleanup value that is 10 times higher than if you had 100%. So you can see how lower RBAs lead to greater reduction in the amount that you would have to clean up. But, of course, this is all going to be based on your specific site. So that's kind of complicated, and there's a lot going on in this slide. So this next set of slides is meant to kind of simplify things a little bit. So here we have just an example site, we show some contamination with a hot spot of 100 milligrams per kilogram. Then we have an outer ring of about 50 milligrams per kilogram, and then we have a defined down to 15 milligrams per kilogram. Now, assuming 100% bioavailability, and we want our cleanup goal, our risk to be a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk, we're going to have a cleanup goal of 10 milligrams per kilogram. So that means that all of these areas that are contaminated would require some kind of remediation removal action. Now, what if, and that would be, you know, a number of, this represents a number of trucks of soil that would have to come in and remove, go through communities, you know, a big cleanup action. So what about applying the US EPA default of 60% for relative bioavailability? Well, now we're still using that same 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk cleanup goal, but now our cleanup goal is 17 milligrams per kilogram. So while we'll still have to remove that hot spot of 150, that 15 milligrams per kilogram is now below our risk-based cleanup goal, and that results in a reduction in the number of trucks that are going to have to come in and soil being removed from that site. And, you know, that's less traffic moving through communities, et cetera. So now, finally, what if we do a site-specific evaluation and our relative bioavailability comes out at 25%? What does that look like? Well, again, still having that same target risk of 1 times 10 to the minus 6, our cleanup goal becomes 40 milligrams per kilogram. So now we need to remove that hot spot of 100 milligrams per kilogram, but the other area is still, you know, is still under our concentration of concern. So now we're looking at only having 3 truckloads worth of soil that are going to have to be removed going through our communities. And so that's just a nice example to show you how bioavailability can impact. So even if you do have concentrations that are higher than what bioavailability is going to allow to stay in place, you can reduce the footprint of what's needed to be cleaned up. So hopefully that simplified version helps. So this is another document that I believe was sent out to you when you first registered. So this is our review checklist. Bryn had referred to this earlier as well. This is in our guidance document, and this is going to help you go through your risk as you're going through your evaluation. So as you're going through an evaluation, as you're reviewing someone who has submitted an evaluation, these are all the things that you should be looking for, that you should make sure that are accounted for. And so this is in our ITRC document to help you move through the process. Finally, I'm just going to go over some site-specific RBA evaluation take-home messages. So first, this is really all about decreasing the uncertainty of the risk assessment. We are refining the risk assessment, making a site-specific risk assessment, which is something that we have done forever in risk assessment. So this isn't necessarily anything new. It's just a new tool that we're using to help decrease the uncertainty of a risk assessment. We're maintaining that same target risk level. So in all of these examples, you know, we were still trying to maintain, that last example I was showing was a one-time SINDA minus six risk. So we're maintaining that same risk value when we make these adjustments. But we improve remedial decision-making. At this point now, potentially, we have a significant savings of resources that can be available for remediation. And so that's really important and can be very helpful. And then the other thing is this really is a very multidisciplinary approach, and you really need to involve your whole team early. So what does that mean? That means from the regulatory standpoint, you know, project managers, geologists, risk assessors, toxicologists, everybody has a role in helping decide where you should sample, what you should sample, how many samples need to be taken, what method is going to be the best method to evaluate. So the whole team needs to be involved. Consultants. You know, obviously everybody needs to be talking to one another to make sure we're all on the same page and the correct information is being gathered and that we're using the correct methods. Stakeholders, responsible parties, and the public. Like we said, it's important that everyone agree that this is something that's going to be useful and acceptable, and we don't want anyone to feel like you go through and do this whole evaluation and someone feels like you're just trying to save a dollar or that you're not being protective of human health. It's very important that everybody get involved early on. And that's the end of our wrap-up, and now we're going to have some time for some more questions. I'm going to hand it back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Valerie. Before we get to those questions, I do want to point out a couple things. We have our links to additional resources, and this page includes several of the ITRC reference guidances that we talked about during today's training class, so a great page for you to have available. Also point out the feedback form. We do look for everyone to fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. We appreciate you taking the time now to fill out the form. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's class. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to confirm you attended, and once you submit, the system's going to generate a certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, because right now the only way to get this certificate is through the feedback form. If you have more than one person at your location, you can have the first person submit the form and then go back and have the next person fill out the feedback form so everybody at your location can generate a certificate. We also have opened a couple final poll questions. Would you recommend assessing bioavailability of contaminants in soils to assess human health risk? And also thinking about the projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And in both cases, you may need to scroll down to see all of the answers as they're coming in. And we do thank you for participating in polls throughout today's class. We are going to have about 10 minutes to answer questions, so feel free to send questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. A couple of questions that trainers have answered already, but I thought they were good questions. What is the typical turnaround time for bioavailability study results after samples are submitted?
So that's really going to depend a little bit on the lab and what your chemical concern is that you're having the bioavailability study done on. But for lead and arsenic, these IVVA analyses are pretty pretty straightforward. They don't take more than a day or two to run, and so, you know, turnover times are relatively quick. I mean, you of course need to discuss with your laboratory beforehand, and there's going to be some variability, but they aren't really long. You know, that's unlike the in vivo when we had to do those. Those would be potentially months before we'd see samples back, so there's pretty quick turnover.
Yeah. I just did a project where the lab suggested they were going to be able to do it a 3-week turnaround, and something got bogged down at the lab, and it actually took about 5 weeks, but still, as Valerie said, that is so much faster than the animal studies.
Is there any guidance available concerning bioavailability in soils of uranium and radium?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there might be, but we certainly didn't cover that in this guidance document. There's none that I'm personally aware of.
Right, and I think the way we are exposed to radiation is not consistent with how we are thinking about bioavailability of other contaminants in soil. So if you're looking at the toxicity of the actual metals, these concepts would apply. But for example, if you're looking at the radioactive toxicity, of course, you would be exposed to that whether or not the metal dissociated or got absorbed out of the gastrointestinal tract. You're getting exposed even while it's in the gastrointestinal tract. So I think that would take some cautious interpretation.
Have you used the bioavailability analysis to calculate a site-specific cleanup objective and then use that to compare to the 95% UCL concentration of the site?
I think that's a great way to use these data. If you can characterize that you have, you can characterize several soils from your site, get an estimate of what the bioavailability is, and then adjust the screening value, and then screen all of your concentrations against that screening value. It's a really efficient way to use the bioavailability information.
Can you share what key messages that you talk with stakeholders outreach when conveying that a higher cleanup level is acceptable?
Yeah, I think I, this is Brent, I answered that one. I think, I was going to try to go back to that real quick and see if I can find it. But one of the things I don't know if we emphasized in the training today is that in our guidance document, there is a stakeholder perspective section. And we went through some of these thoughts and discussions when we developed that. So I'd encourage folks to take a quick look at that. What I think would be quite useful in presenting to the public is something similar to what Yvette presented in the bioavailability basics. Simplify some of that information and just talk about this concept of a contaminant that gets into the gastrointestinal tract. Does it pass right through it, or does it actually affect the body? And I think that's one of the that's sort of the founding principle of all of this. To me, that seems like if you can simplify that message, that to me seems like that'll be the nugget on a fact sheet. And then you'd have to kind of add some other information in there, I think, about the methods and understanding that they're approved, and it's not just us on our own or this regulatory agency or a consultant, you know, out there in the woods. This is something that is being developed, well, I mean, has been accepted by EPA and other regulatory agencies. Another thought I had on that was maybe you could find some similar projects where that type of work was done and had good results and had and showed how the community outreach was done.
And I also thought that was an interesting question. A couple of things that I have used is, first of all, the issue of bioavailability is generally understood by people. You know, we talk about forms of iron being more bioavailable from meat, for example, than they are from mineral sources. So people who have low iron are seeking higher bioavailable forms. We talk about that with our calcium supplements. You know, anyone goes to the vitamin aisle, you can see myriad calcium supplements in different forms, and that's there's discussion about how those are absorbed. So the concept of bioavailability and absorption seems to be comfortable for people to understand. The other thing that I think can be really useful, and we touched on it several times in the presentation, we touched on it many times in the document, is that incorporating bioavailability adjustments into a risk assessment is refining the risk assessment. Sometimes people hear, oh, this gives you a higher cleanup value, and so it just saves the polluter money. But what's really going on is that the risk assessment process starts with screening values that have very conservative default assumptions. And then when you move to a site-specific risk assessment, there are lots of opportunities for tuning in the risk assessment to make it more specific to your site. You might have snow cover, and so you incorporate that. You might have people who eat fish, and you incorporate that. There are you might have home gardens or not have home gardens. So all of those things get incorporated to refine the risk assessment, and bioavailability is one of those things that allows you to refine it.
Thank you. Looking at our poll results, thank you all for answering the polls. So projects that you're working on where you could use this guidance, we have some legacy sites. We have someone working on risk communications, and they're going to be able to use this. Refinery sites is another place, and you're welcome to scroll through and see all the different answers that have come in for that question. We do have another 5 minutes, so I will see if we have another question or two that comes in. A reminder, if you haven't already, please fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. Not only are we going to improve today's course, but we are also developing new courses right now, and the feedback that you provide is something that we use when we work for trainers with those new courses and help reinforce some good learning. And also, you're welcome to give us positive comments. What worked well? What we should continue to do in not only this course, but in other courses that we offer? We don't have any other questions coming in, so we'll go ahead and wrap up. If we didn't answer your question completely, or if you are typing